Welcome to The Sound of Economics, the podcast series by Bruegel, the Brussels-based economics think tank. This episode is part of our summer 2023 special series, Read with Bruegel. In this series, we have the pleasure of hosting renowned authors who will discuss various economic issues based on their insightful books. We hope that this conversation will inspire you to explore their books and offer you some food for thought during your summer break. I'm Maria Demergis, and joining me today is Agatha Desmarais. Hello, Agatha.
Hello, thanks for having me today.
Agatha is the Global Forecasting Director of the Economist Intelligence Unit and has written a very timely and insightful book called Backfire: How Sanctions Reshape the World Against US Interests. Agatha, thank you for joining us today. And we picked your book because not only is it very interesting, very insightful, but it's also extremely timely. It's interesting that you finished your book in the conclusions saying the following things. As I write these lines, the year 2022 has just started, marking the third anniversary of this book project. Authors often worry that their topic will go out of fashion. We anxiously follow the news to make sure that the media have not moved on to a different issue. This is the beginning of 2022, and you're worried that your book will be out of fashion. Events have proved you wrong. The book has been extremely timely. I presume this is a coincidence. But what you write in the book, and indeed the topic you tackle, has been of incredible relevance during 2022 and will continue to be of incredible relevance for the years to come. But perhaps tell us a little bit about what brought you to the book. What is your motivation and what is your really main message from the book?
Well, I would say that my history with sanctions has been a bit of a personal history because I was actually working for French Treasury in 2014 in Moscow when Russia annexed Crimea and started to back separatist rebels in the Donbas region of eastern Ukraine. And so from one day to another, I joined a sanctions task force for the French Treasury, working, of course, in collaboration with the European Union and also like-minded allies. And that was my intro to sanctions. And to be honest, it was a bit of a crash course in sanctions. Maybe I even Googled sanctions at the time or looked on Wikipedia because I had no idea exactly how sanctions worked. But I tried to learn. And so I worked on Russia sanctions in 2014. And then still for French Treasury, I moved to Lebanon in the Middle East, covering 15 countries in the Middle East, including Iran, Syria, Iraq. So a number of countries that have been or are still under sanctions. And I was actually on the ground in 2015 when the JCPOA, the Iran nuclear deal, was signed. And I remember actually at the time, what was striking to me is that in my conversations with Syrians, well, they would tell me, oh, sanctions are making it impossible for me to, for instance, buy a bicycle for my son for his birthday. And at the time, I was very skeptical. I wasn't entirely sure this was due to sanctions. And so I found it really interesting already at the time to take a look at the side effects of sanctions. It was a bit of the same when I was in Russia. We would talk to European companies and they would tell us, oh, sanctions are important, but they have these side effects and ripple effects. And I was skeptical. And at the same time, maybe there was some truth to it. So I thought it would be interesting to investigate this. And then in 2017, I moved to London for the Economist Intelligence Unit. I did what nobody does. I quit the French civil service. And I was actually covering the Nord Stream 2 saga when the US imposed a lot of sanctions against the Nord Stream 2 pipeline connecting. Well, that was due to connect Russia to Germany and also the US exit from the JCPOA. And overall, I thought it would be interesting to take a look at the side effects, the global side effects of sanctions. And here I am. My book was published in 2022. And as you've said, sadly, it's been extremely timely.
Yeah, absolutely. It's interesting, actually, and this is what fascinated me about the book, the fact that, you know, we talk about sanctions, but we typically talk about the effectiveness of sanctions. Do they really achieve what they're intended to do? And we look at the results. Has it really achieved in the context of Russia? Has it stopped Russia from energy revenues or has it stopped trade with others? We never really think about the side effects. And your book is very much, as the title suggests, Backfire, really is about the side effects. You have a chapter 4. who is very much about humanitarian side effects from sanctions. And you have a number of interesting anecdotes of ways of justifying the side effects. And walk us through the humanitarian side effects of sanctions in the context, of course, of sanctions that have already existed, not Russian, the current Russian effect.
Well, yes, I think that it's important to take a look at the side effects and humanitarian negative ripple effects of sanctions. I think that we need to have an honest discussion about this. And I should say here, the book is absolutely not anti-sanctions, quite the opposite. I do say that sanctions are extremely important for Western policymakers because they fill the void between empty diplomatic declarations on the one hand and deadly military interventions on the other hand. So they are extremely important tools. But it's a bit like antibiotics. We need to know the side effects and the ripple effects of a medicine to make sure that we use this medicine when it is relevant and appropriate. And so in the book, I try to use some case studies to discuss these side effects. And I use the case study of Iran because there has been, during the COVID pandemic, a lot of controversies regarding the humanitarian side effects of sanctions against Iran. These were US sanctions, unilateral sanctions that the US reimposed following the US exit from the Iran nuclear deal. And I'm sure that we will go a bit deeper into this question, but I try to argue in this case study, and we can go into the details, that simply lifting sanctions on Iran during the COVID pandemic would not have been enough to completely restore trade between Iran and, for instance, Western countries that could have provided more masks or more medicines, because sanctions have such deep structural impacts that simply lifting them is not enough. And I think that this is sometimes underestimated by Western policymakers.
Yeah. Let's go back a little bit and tell us a little bit the problem during the pandemic, what had happened, and which had humanitarian ripple effects. And then we go into understanding also why it was, you know, the sanctions, not only imposing sanctions have side effects, but removing them is also problematic. And, you know, this is an interesting point because we're going to see this ahead of us in the context of Russia today. How do we lift sanctions? Can we lift sanctions? And but this is not for the moment, but it's something for the future. But walk us through the incident that you describe in the book, Iran pandemic medicine provision.
Yes. So obviously Iran, just like many other countries, all other countries pretty much, was facing a dire situation at the start of the COVID pandemic. It needed more medicines. It needed more personal protective equipment, such as masks, to tackle the pandemic. And what I found really interesting at the time is that if we think about it, the Iranian government made sanctions the scapegoat for its own shortcomings, saying, well, you know, we would like to do more, but of course we are a country under sanctions, so we cannot do more. And this is a line that is often used by countries under sanctions. I would say if you take a look at Cuba, all the economic problems in Cuba, the government has already made answers. Oh, it's because of sanctions. But I actually explain in the book that the problem was really multifaceted and that there were a number of issues that Iran was facing, and it went well beyond sanctions. The first one is actually related to sanctions, if we are honest, because the US government was arguing at the time that sanctions do not target humanitarian goods that are being exported to Iran, which includes medicine and food. But actually, the process to export these goods is extremely difficult for countries under sanctions. You know, you need to have some licenses. You need to prove to the US government that this equipment is really what you say that it is. So overall, it is a lot of compliance. It is a big financial burden. So it's not really surprising that a number of companies say, okay, we're not going to try to do this because it's simply too complicated. Then there is a second set of issues, and it's about the financial sector. Because even if you manage to get these exemptions, well, it is extremely difficult to find banks, Western banks at least, that will be willing to do trade with Iran. And this is for a number of reasons. You know, this is because some banks have decided to exit the Iranian market a number of years ago. There is also the reputational risk, because it is very difficult to know who you're doing business with in Iran. It's a particularly murky destination. And also, There is another problem. It is that Iran is still on the blacklist of the Financial Action Task Force because it's not implemented a number of rules to combat illicit financing, money laundering, et cetera, et cetera. So it is very difficult to find a bank that is willing to do business with Iran. So I think that this is also very important because what this points to is the fact that it goes beyond government-imposed sanctions. It is also about the private sector not being willing to work in some destinations. And it is impossible to influence the decisions of the private sector. And I think that this is also something that is important to keep in mind for sanctions lifting. Even if sanctions are lifted, a number of companies may still be unwilling to go back to sanctioned countries.
Is that like a case of sanctions being too effective?
It is the case, and it is also the case of sanctions being sometimes very difficult to understand. And I actually explain in the book that this may sometimes be intentional because this chilling effect magnifies the impact of sanctions. And at the same time, American policymakers may be able to say, oh, but this is not prohibited. This is completely possible. This is not outlawed. But in practice, it is very difficult. And so this reinforces the impact of sanctions while giving some deniability for the American government. And then finally, I think that it is important to recognize that there were some logistical issues and that the entire world was short of masks and medicines.
Indeed. Yeah. Here in Europe too. Yeah.
And so it was extremely unlikely that facing all of these difficulties, companies would be willing to divert supplies that they could sell at a very high price in Western countries to Iran. And I think that what I try to show in this case study is that it is extremely difficult to disentangle what is really due to the impact of sanctions, what is due to decisions from the private sector, what is due to banks not being willing to work in some destinations. And so overall, this has important lessons from my perspective for sanctions lifting, because if simply lifting sanctions is not enough to cancel their side effects and their effects, pretty much, then it means that a number of countries under sanctions will not have any incentives to change their behaviors to essentially comply with Western demands. And from my perspective, this poses a number of important questions. And perhaps it is important to think about sanctions lifting when sanctions are being imposed to make sure that the bargain, the deal, will be palatable for sanctioned countries.
Before I make the next comment, but tell us a little bit about what the humanitarian impact of such difficulties effectively were in Iran during the start of the pandemic.
So essentially, when you ask the population of targeted countries about the humanitarian side effects of sanctions, the first one that they will pretty much always mention is inflation. And it is true, there have been a number of studies showing that inflation is a clear side effect and ripple effect from sanctions. Because, you know, sanctions can restrict imports, for instance. This is certainly the case in Iran. This is also the case in Russia. And this has a direct impact on households. So I would say that inflation is the main one. But in the case of Iran, there have been actually reports for a number of years about the fact that there are issues for the supply of some medicines to Iran, for instance, for multiple sclerosis or for cancer treatments. And this is absolutely true. And this is all linked to the issues that we've discussed. Western companies oftentimes do not feel that it is worth the risk to engage in what they see as a very risky market. And they also fear that sanctions could be even reinforced. You know, I remember from my conversations with European company when I was in Lebanon after 2015, and I was trying to tell them, go back to Iran, because as a French government official, my job was to convince European companies to go back to Iran so Tehran would stay in the nuclear deal and abide with its provisions. And companies would tell us, but we're not really keen because we're very worried that the US will reimpose sanctions or that some retroactive sanctions will appear. And so they found it extremely risky. And at the time, it was my job to say, no, don't worry, everything will be fine. But of course, in 2018, history proved them right. You know, this is exactly what happened. And the US reimposed sanctions against Iran. So I think overall, it's difficult to disentangle the structural impact. It's absolutely not the case that sanctions should not be imposed. But I think that we need to have a clearer view about these side effects and these ripple effects to make sure that sanctions are as effective as possible with fewer side effects, especially on the population.
I think Iran might be a bit of a specific case, but, you know, I suppose every country is a specific case, right? But typically when we impose sanctions, this was certainly the case this time around in 2022, certainly for the EU that has very little experience with imposing sanctions, this is something you have to do very quickly. You don't really know how to impose sanctions, let alone what you just said. Think about how you're going to have to remove sanctions. You know, so this is a little bit, learning on the go, as it were, in the sense that you understand what it all means, even down to, if you remember, the saga of having to pay for oil in rubles was very much related to the fact that having imposed sanctions, then Putin didn't have access to the money that we were paying, we being Europeans, simply because it was in euros and he could not clear those euros in the European settlement system. And therefore, he asked to be paid in rubles just to bypass the sanctions, right? But this isn't something that, you know, everybody had sat down and done, thought about, this is how we're going to do it, simply because you do it immediately. And of course, the side effects, the intended and unintended consequences, is something you find out along the way. The US has more experience with doing that. It has imposed sanctions a lot more often. But even there, you see that there are difficulties in understanding the side effects. I found very interesting in your book is during the COVID, because I think that was a very, of course, it was a big shock, global shock. But it was also the fact how the effects were used strategically by the internal politics is to blame the Westerns for, even down to the variation of the variant of the virus that had affected the country was much stronger simply because there were sanctions. It was used instrumentally, right? But at the detriment, of course, of human lives who lost access to important medicines and to protective material, right? I wonder if you could discuss also something which is chapter 9, I think, in your book, which is, again, extremely relevant in the current circumstances. This is the chapter where you talk much more about, let me broadly call it financial sanctions, which is something which is actually quite new, much newer than in previous circumstances. We typically think about trade sanctions. Financial sanctions in the case of Russia were particularly unique because they targeted the central bank. It's something that we hadn't done before at that scale. And we continue to struggle with what it all means. And then you also talk about the creation of digital currencies as ways of bypassing sanctions. Can you walk us through the main elements of your chapter 9?
Yes, absolutely. So essentially, chapter 9 is about what I call sanctions vaccination. It is okay. About a number of countries. You see, there are a lot of metaphors from the medicine field. Yeah. Essentially, it is about countries trying to vaccinate themselves against sanctions. And it makes perfect sense, you know, because there are a number of countries that know that they don't exactly have great relations with Western countries at the moment. And so they feel they could fall under sanctions or they are already under sanctions. And I think that it is important here to use this word vaccination because it is not sanctions evasion. Sanctions evasion is something entirely different. What I talk about when I talk about sanctions vaccination is actually preemptive measures to make it impossible for Western countries to impose sanctions against some economies. And so, as you said, sanctions are financial. Western countries don't really do trade embargoes anymore. And actually, this is a good transition from our conversation, because the reason why Western countries don't do trade embargoes anymore is that these tend to have massive humanitarian side effects. So this is really not a great option. And so sanctions nowadays target financial channels. It is actually up to banks to check the compliance of every transaction that they process with Western sanctions. Obviously, we're talking about Western banks.
Yeah.
And so it makes sense for countries that want to avoid sanctions or vaccinate themselves against sanctions to have a look at these financial channels and to think of alternatives, non-Western financial channels that would allow them to process transactions without any oversight from Western institutions. And we're thinking here about the US, of course. So there are three key steps. The first step is de-dollarization. It's been all over the news. You know, we are seeing, for instance, Russia sending oil to Pakistan with some payment in renminbi. And it is not really surprising. It is a first rather blunt step for countries that want to vaccinate themselves against sanctions, because if you don't have what is called a nexus, a link to the US, you don't use the US dollar, then it makes US sanctions a bit less effective. And so, unsurprisingly, we're seeing this, for instance, between Russia and China. Since 2021, as I mentioned in the book, Russia and China have denominated their bilateral trade mostly in Russian rubles and in Chinese renminbi. This is not random. You were mentioning the Russian central bank reserves being frozen. It is only half of these reserves that could be blocked or frozen. And the reason for that is that the other half was denominated in non-Western currency. So we're seeing that Russia had taken some preemptive steps here to try to vaccinate itself against sanctions. So de-dollarization is the first tool. However, I think that we need to be honest. It would be of no use if countries under sanctions still use, for instance, SWIFT. Because we know that in 2012, Western countries, well, a US-led coalition, very much US-led, because the EU wasn't exactly on board, at least in the beginning, cut the access of all Iranian banks to SWIFT. And SWIFT is a global Rolodex connecting all banks to each other. It's about routing financial wires.
It's a messaging system, right?
Yes, messaging system, but like a mail room to make sure that every financial transfer goes in the right direction. And so what happened is that this 2012 decision to cut off Iranian banks from the SWIFT network was really a red flag or a wake-up call for countries that feel that they could fall under sanctions. And since then, they've been trying to develop alternatives to SWIFT. And the main one is Chinese. It's called SIPS. It is much smaller than SWIFT, because this is usually the argument that is given to say, oh, no, this is very small. It will never work. It is much smaller, but it already connects 1,300 banks. All Western banks are connected to SIPS. And China doesn't want to have the biggest system. What it wants is to have a plan B, a backup plan in case it were cut off from SWIFT. And actually, we're talking here about a defensive capability, but there could be some offensive capability too, because one day China could say, oh, you know, if you want to access the Chinese market or do business with us, you need to use SIPS. And that would actually give China the capability to cut off entire countries or companies from its market of 1.4 billion people that could become the largest economy in the world. It's already the biggest manufacturing power in the world. So quite a big development here. And finally, the third development is digital currencies. And we've seen recently that the EU wants to launch a digital euro. And obviously, this is very important because digital currencies are the third step for sanctions vaccination for a number of countries. And again, China leads the way with a digital yuan that is already used by 300 million Chinese people. But China is actually looking very much forward, and it has launched pilot projects to settle trade with its digital currency with Thailand and the UAE. And such a digital currency is completely immune to sanctions. It gives China big tracking surveillance capabilities, and it is completely immune to sanctions.
Why is it immune to sanctions? Can you walk us through that?
Well, because essentially you can, if you want, impose sanctions on China's digital currency, but Chinese people can still use it to settle trade domestically. You know, it's stored on the digital wallets of their mobile phones. It is issued by the Chinese central bank, and they can use it for domestic transactions. And then they can also, well, that's what China would like to do. They can use it for trade. And there is no US nexus here. So the US can sanction the digital currency all it wants. It's actually, if we make a parallel, another story that I tell in the book is when the Nord Stream 2 pipeline fell under stringent US sanctions, what Russia did is that it hired boats with Russian crews, and these were Russian boats insured by Russian companies. Everything was Russian. So there was virtually zero tie to Western countries. And that's how actually Russia built the Nord Stream 2 pipeline. So this insulation from anything Western is actually very, very powerful.
Yeah, effectively, you've just given us a very good description of the weaponization of finance, right? And it's not just about the Western countries using finance as weapon. It's, as you say, it's also China, the next big country, using some of the financial links as weapons to protect itself, but also the offensive. That's actually a very interesting argument. The issue of de-dollarization, though, if I can go back and understand a little bit the future of that. I mean, so the dollar is useful for two reasons. It's a very strong currency. I mean, and we prefer good currencies to bad currencies. But it is also a currency of choice because of the infrastructure to settle. As you said, I mean, you know, Chile trades with India. They do it mostly in dollars, right? Now, if you were to have another means of trading rather than the dollar, the fear of sanctions and what you call the vaccination process, which means that I'm looking for something that I can do, I can continue to trade without having to necessarily use the dollar, right? But how quickly do you think this could happen? Because, I mean, the dollar still is a very, very strong currency. What we observed in 2022 is a 10% reduction in global reserves, but not just in the dollar. All currencies went down. Eh? So the shares remained the same. About 60% are dollar reserves, 20% is euro. But actually, what countries did globally, central banks globally, they bought gold. This is what happened. 10% increase in the reserves held in gold, and therefore moved away from currency. So there is a fear that we have to recognize. There is a fear that currencies are being weaponized. But, you know, the Americans themselves do not believe that the dollar will lose its luster anytime soon because it is a strong currency. Do you agree with that?
Yes, I absolutely agree. Essentially, what I try to explain in the book is that I think we tend to have a black and white view about this.
Yeah.
The debate is often framed, you know, with one side saying, okay, the dollar is going to remain the hegemonic currency with no challenger. And the other side would say, oh, the dollar is going to disappear altogether. I don't think this is true. I think the truth is in the gray zone. And I actually explain in the book that we're seeing geopolitical fragmentation. And I would expect, maybe I'm wrong, that financial developments will mirror this geopolitical fragmentation. So we could have the coexistence of several currencies. We could have the US dollar, we could have the Chinese renminbi, we could have hopefully the euro coexisting and reflecting this geopolitical fragmentation.
Yeah.
The second thing is you mentioned what is really important is to have the infrastructure to settle. And this is critical and this will take a lot of time. So we're really not talking about a digital renminbi replacing the US dollar for all transactions, even within 10 years. We're really talking about several decades. And actually what China is trying to do here and what I find really interesting is that China is betting that digital currencies are the future because we're living in a digital world and it wants to have a first mover advantage to set the standards in this field. Because there is a quote that I have in the book, it's from the Baron von Siemens, and he says, who rules the standards essentially rules the market. And it makes a lot of sense if you impose the standards. And finally, the third thing is that when we talk about sanctions vaccination, it's not about one magic trick. If we take the three tools that I mentioned, de-dollarization, alternatives to SWIFT, and central bank digital currencies, any of this tool taken in isolation cannot dent the effectiveness of sanctions. But it's about having all of these tools taken together that could gradually give alternatives to sanctioned countries, but also groups involved in illicit activities, for instance, nuclear proliferation or terror groups. You know, they would have alternatives to process their transactions outside Western financial channels. And I think that this is a very important development to track.
You're painting a grim picture, right? I mean, in the sense that, you know, the future is fragmentation and the tools that are being developed is very much about this fragmentation, right? And I think the interesting thing would be how do you reverse that process, given that we are not going to solve the issue of climate, for example, unless we do it all together. It's very difficult to imagine that the world is going to sit around the table and talk about climate and then they're going to impose sanctions on all other things, right? I mean, nothing is solved till everything is solved, right? Let me come back to the book. There is one more chapter that I think was interesting, again, because of its extreme relevance as we move forward, and that is on tech. This is your chapter 10, I believe, where you talk about tech and effectively about what we see now, export controls. Again, very prophetically, you emphasized the export controls as the future. Tell us about the gist of your chapter 10.
So essentially in chapter 10, I argue that export controls will be the sanctions of tomorrow. And I think that there are two assumptions behind this forecast, if we talk like forecasters. The first assumption is the sanctions vaccination trend that we've just discussed. If we agree that in coming decades, sanctions could gradually, slowly lose part of their effectiveness, they won't become ineffective from one day to another, but maybe become a bit less effective. That's the first assumption. The second assumption is about technology being extremely important. And I think that this is something that we see in the battlefield in Ukraine at the moment. I would actually argue, and maybe we will talk about this, that some of the most important and effective restrictions that Western countries have imposed against Russia are about curbs to Russia's ability to import semiconductors, because all military gear today is full of semiconductors, and these semiconductors are usually manufactured using American technology. They're built physically in Taiwan or South Korea mostly, but the technology is American. And so if we have these two assumptions, and I actually was working on this part of the book in 2021, and you know, at the beginning, I wasn't planning to work on export controls, but I could sense that something was happening. And I know we're saying this is definitely happening. We actually are seeing a phase where access to tech is so critical that the most effective way to impose economic costs on an adversary is about curbing their access to tech. And this is exactly what we're seeing with US restrictions on China's access to semiconductors, for instance. But this goes well beyond that, because we actually can expect US measures on other technology aspects. If we go back to the speeches from Jake Sullivan, we can see that the US is also keen to restrict China's access, for instance, to quantum technology and AI technology and biotech. So it really shows that tech will be the crux of the battle, and the tool to restrict access to tech is really export controls. And so far, this is exactly what we're seeing in the news these days.
It did. And even in Europe today, we're seeing that the Dutch government, you know, actually bowing to US pressures to do exactly this, to control and restrict the access to semiconductor bits of the technology to China. Again, as I said, very prophetically, this will be the future, right? The way that we control some of the issues. I wanted to come back to this, to what goes on today in Russia. Obviously, the war is still very much in place. Europe has imposed the energy sanctions now by the beginning of 2023. I said that's on oil, on gas. In any case, we are still very much declining, hoping that by the end of the year, we will have become autonomous from all Russian energy. But about the sanctions, and you mentioned it en passant, actually, the issue of restricting the tech aspects of the Russians. Do you have a view on whether the sanctions that we've imposed will effectively stop Russia from waging war? How do you see the effectiveness of sanctions before we even think about the side effects?
My view is that sanctions on Russia are effective, but I think that there is a lot of debate about this. And to me, this stems from the fact that there is a lack of clarity around the objectives of sanctions against Russia. So I think it's important here to define what the objectives are not and what the objectives are when we talk about sanctions against Russia. I think the first one is that it is not about economic collapse. This is simply impossible. Essentially, we're talking about the world's ninth largest economy. It has huge financial reserves, a major commodities exporter. So I don't think that economic collapse is a possibility. The second one is that I don't think it's about regime change. If there is one thing that history shows, is that sanctions that are being imposed to provoke regime change pretty much never work. And finally, the third thing is that I don't think that sanctions are going to be a magical tool that will change the calculus of Vladimir Putin in Ukraine from one day to another. If anything, we've seen that this hasn't been the case since 2014. We don't have the counterfactual, but still.
Yeah. If I may, when we did impose sanctions, we being the European Union, if you look at the speeches that came out of the European Commission, the objective was very much what you called number one. So effectively to stop the economic ability of Russia to wage war. It wasn't about regime change. And I think there was some mistakes that were done also in the US in this context. Very much all the intention was stop revenues for Russia. And therefore, if you stop revenues for Russia, you stop the ability to wage war. Well, we know that, first of all, the European Union didn't stop paying Russia for the whole of 2022. Huge amounts of money, to the order of 140 billion we paid to Russia. So we did not stop the streams. But had we stopped the revenue stream, wouldn't that have had an effect?
So I completely agree with you. That's the main objective. It is to weigh on Russia's ability to finance the war. But from my perspective, it is very different from an economic collapse. And I think, at least in the French debate, there has been some confusion between degrading Russia's financing and economic collapse, which is an entirely different thing, and I don't think is even possible. So this leads us to objectives of sanctions against Russia from my perspective. The first objective is a diplomatic one. I think it is important to recognize that sanctions sent a strong message of resolve and unity from Western countries towards Ukraine, but also towards Russia. I don't think that Vladimir Putin expected such stringent sanctions to be imposed. So I don't think that we should discount that diplomatic effect altogether. And then the second objective, as you said, it's about degrading Russia's ability to finance the war. And I think from that perspective, again, it's not a black and white thing. We're not saying that Russia will have zero revenues from the day sanctions are imposed, but it's about curbing these revenues. And I think that when we take a look at the data, this is working. We're seeing that in the first quarter of 2023, so after the EU imposed an embargo on Russian oil imports, we're seeing that Russia's fiscal revenues from oil exports have dropped by 30% year on year. This is quite significant. And in the first quarter of 2023, Russia was already at 80% of its full year budget deficit target. So very significant. And the idea, I would say, is to put these constraints on the Russian regime, because financing social stability is costly and important for the survival of the Putin regime from his perspective. But at the same time, financing the war is also very costly. So it's about pushing Putin to make difficult choices. Again, it's not an all or nothing thing, but it's about pushing the regime to make tough choices. And then finally, the third objective from my perspective is about technology. And it has a long-term objective and a short-term objective. I will start with the short-term objective. Actually, we've already mentioned it. It's about curbing the ability of the Russian military sector to access semiconductors, to build missiles, for instance, that are used on the battlefield. Of course, sanctions evasion is happening, but probably not at the scale that Russia needs to fill the needs of its big military sector. And then the second objective is a long-term one. And actually, I discussed it in the book. And in the book, I argue that this is possibly the most effective and most stringent sanction imposed on Russia. And it dates back to 2014. And it is about curbing Russia's access to technology and financing for its energy sector. And why is that significant? Well, because Russia is obviously a big energy exporter. That's the Russian economic model. A number of Russian energy fields are coming to maturity. That is to say that their reserves are fast being depleted. So Russia needs to build new oil and gas fields. Reserves are located mostly in the Arctic, very tough conditions. And the technology to develop these fields is exclusively American. And Russia will not have access to this technology. And so in the long run, I argue that there is a strong chance that Russia will lose its status as a global energy superpower. And if you add to this the impact of the global energy transition, I think it is fairly clear that in the long run, the Russian economy will not be doing very well.
That's right. I mean, the model of energy dependence is going to shift completely given the energy transition. So I think I agree with you that in the long term, irrespective of the sanctions element, that the model will collapse because nobody will be wanting to buy the type of energy that Russia has to offer. So, but of course, we're not seeing any signals of Russia now thinking about the future economic model on which it will grow. I think it has more urgent problems to solve right now. But I think you're right that in the long term, the Russian model will collapse. And with that, tell us a little bit about what you're working on right now. What is the next big thing that is on your radar? Given your track record of prophecies, I would be interested to hear what comes next.
So I would say three key things that I'm working on at the moment. No new books so far, because I think my family would go on strike. I'm not sure my husband would agree with that. It's indeed a pity. But maybe one day. So essentially, I would say three big things. The first one is that there is still a lot of work to do about Russia sanctions and the effectiveness of sanctions. And a particular aspect of this to me is Russian disinformation linked to sanctions. I think that there is a lot of this in the global south, mostly. Russia is trying to use sanctions to sow dissent and to fuel resentment against Western countries by, for instance, saying that sanctions fuel energy insecurity or food insecurity. This is wrong, absolutely wrong. But I think there is some work to do here, and obviously some work to do about how to make sanctions more effective, which sectors need to be targeted. Is it about more effective implementation, etc.? So Russia sanctions, of course, is a big one. The second big one that I'm working on is de-risking, because that's all the rage, I would say, in the policy debate at the moment. So I'm trying to have a think about what this means. How can we define de-risking? What does it mean for Europe? Because we have these two blocks emerging. We were talking about geopolitical fragmentation. I think that is very clear. We have a US bloc. We have a China-led bloc. Where does that leave Europe? Can Europe emerge as an autonomous actor? What does that mean for European companies? So obviously, I think that this is extremely important. And then the final aspect is about tech and export controls, because I think that we can expect more of these. We were talking about it on AI, on quantum, on biotech, on a number of emerging technologies. So I'm trying to have a think about what this means for European companies. And obviously, this is very difficult also because supply chains are so merged between the US and Europe and other like-minded Western allies. But these are the three things that I'm working on at the moment.
What, in your view, would be necessary for international cooperation to kind of to pick up again? Because all of this is divisive and all of this leads to a fragmentation of the world where everybody goes their own way, but actually problems are common. So what do we need to do to think about solving the big issues?
That's a big question. I think that if there was a definitive answer, hopefully it would be implemented in practice. I think that essentially the topics that we're talking about, as you said, are very divisive. So it's about making it possible to decide that some topics will be divisive. I think that we can expect that the US will take some decisions that Europe will not like. And maybe Europe will take some decisions
and has already.
that the US will not like, for instance, about the IRA. I think this was a case in point about the US taking unilateral decisions that have an impact on Europe and Europe not being consulted. But at the same time, I think that it's important to recognize there are other issues where we can collaborate. So let's agree to disagree on these ones. Industrial policy, I think, will be a clear topic for disagreement. But let's agree to talk on climate change. Let's have a view about which topics we can collaborate on and which topics, well, we need to collaborate on them, but it's going to be much, much trickier to find some consensus. And I think that we've mentioned climate change a number of times in our discussion. This is a clear one where we need to have everyone on board, but this will be extremely difficult, you know, given the state of relations with China, for instance, given the resentment in the global south against Western countries that are, you know, seen to have polluted for many decades and many centuries, actually, with the global south now suffering from the consequences. I think that these topics will be extremely divisive. I found it really interesting in recent weeks. There was the Paris summit for a new global financial pact. And I thought that this was an interesting first step to try to have everyone at the table around a precise topic. It was all about debt restructurings, which is a precise technical topic. And I think that maybe this is one way to go, you know, find some topics where we can collaborate. Although I'm not sure that China was precisely very happy about the Paris summit because it was all about countering China's influence. But trying to find some concrete topics where we can collaborate and agree to disagree on the others would be my pragmatic view. I don't think that we can agree on everything, even with our allies.
Agatha, thank you so much for joining us today and for telling us the interesting bits that you're working on in the future. We will be watching for your writings and very insightful comments that you make on issues that are of extreme relevance. Thank you very much for coming, and I strongly recommend our audience to our listeners to have a look at Agatha's book, as we said, it's called Backfire and How Sanctions Reshape the World Against US Interests. It's a wonderful read, a little bit dark read if you ask me, but it is a very important read to understand the logic behind all the sanctions and their effects, including their side effects. With that, I would like to thank you for listening to us today. I wish you a very good summer, happy reading, and follow us on Bruegel.org. Thank you and bye-bye.